Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to our bonus Q&A episode of Books of the Year. I say it's a bonus edition. I mean, you're kind of used to the fact that Norfolk comes on and every single, it's like part two of the interview. John O'Farrell is here. His book is, you've described it in great detail.
Yeah, we have. Family politics.
And it looks, it's got pink and white stripes. It looks as though it's something out of a candy store.
Yes.
But it's not, it's very, very funny. And that's family politics. You can hear John talk about that in our previous podcast. So, John, first of all, question number one, what is the last book that you really, really enjoyed reading, if you have time to read in between coming up with successful shows, films?
I really enjoyed Fintan O'Toole's book, We Don't Know Ourselves, which is a sort of memoir of modern Ireland, really. And he's written from the about Ireland's sort of social history of it from when he was born in 58 right through to now. And if you think about what Ireland has gone through from this country where it was really a sort of papal theocracy, really, where the priests would say, oh, we don't think we really approve of that show being put on. And they would pull the, you know, adaptation of James Joyce. It didn't have any of the rude bits in, but they just didn't really approve. Right through to abortion being illegal, divorce being illegal, women having to give up their jobs when they got married. That was, you know, the marriage bar. And then they became this sort of fashionable, progressive Celtic tiger, all in one generation, really, or one or two generations. And it's just a really funny, entertaining book about a country and about his life, but more about the country. And I found it really gripping, and I've recommended it to so many people who've got any sort of Irish connection to them. I'm sort of half Irish and I've go through Ireland a lot, so I know a lot about what they're talking about. So that was a great memoir, a national memoir, really. And then the other book, again about sort of touching on Ireland, that I read was Killing Thatcher by Rory Carroll. It reads like a thriller. It's about the Brighton bomb and the search for Patrick McGee afterwards. And I do a history podcast with Angela Barnes called We Are History. So I read a lot of history books, and every week we read a book each and we talk about that. And we sort of inform with jokes our listeners about that particular episode in history. So I did a very recent one because this book had entertained me so much and been so interesting. But just you think of the audacity and the logistics of assassinating a prime minister, and then the job of catching this master criminal falls to the Sussex County Constabulary. It's not the FBI. It's not, you know, MI5. It falls to the local plod. And it's an amazing book. So hats off to those two. A novel I really loved. I've just been getting into Elizabeth Taylor very late. And I appreciate that many of your listeners are going, how could you not have discovered Elizabeth Taylor before? But Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont is a very funny book. Very sad book about just being old, and all these rather posh old people have been dumped in this hotel in, you know, Hammersmith stroke Kensington. And it just captures that awkwardness of manners and competitiveness between these old people. There's just a great scene near the beginning where the menu gets typed up and puts in the hallway, and they all just wander out as if they've got another reason to go into the hallway, and they just glance at the typed up menu, and you think, oh, that's about the most exciting thing that's going to happen that morning for these people. But it's done with great humanity and love. And she's a very funny writer.
Okay, so that's three recommendations. I was just thinking when you were talking about the Fintan O'Toole.
Yes.
And we were talking about Bob Geldof in our previous conversation. When the Boomtown Rats did, well, it's Banana Republic, but the way Geldof sings it, it's Banana Republic.
Right.
It's all about, it's Banana Republic, Septic Isle, the black and blue uniforms of police and priests.
Yeah.
And that island that he was writing about in my kind of rock and roll library, that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, yeah. No, I gave this a copy of that book to Bob Geldof, actually, and said, you've got to read this, it's fantastic. And because he's that much older than me, so he will remember all that. And of course, grew up in a very austere island of the 50s and 60s, was sent to a private school, Black Rock College. So he knows all that stuff. And, you know, just even the attitudes of my father were quite socially conservative because he'd grown up in Ireland in the sort of, you know, before the war.
It is. I remember going on holiday to Ireland in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. So it was still that then. Yeah. And it's amazing to me that in the space of, as you say, a generation, it's 20 to 30 years, the country has completely changed.
And it's quite moving when you hear older people talking about voting in favour of gay marriage. And they go, well, sure, we all know someone who's a gay, don't we? And you think, oh, that's so sweet. That would have been so shocking to them a generation before. But then they're all going, well, you know, Mary, your sister's friend, she's a lesbian, I think. And it's like, it's fine. Everyone goes, oh, it's fine. Yeah. It's so sort of liberating and empowering somehow.
Do you always, once you've started a book, do you always finish it?
No, I think it's quite important to say to yourself that you don't have to. You know, our time on this earth is limited. And if you're 100 pages in and you're not getting anything out of it and you're not enjoying it, move on to another book. There's too many books to read in a lifetime. And I used to feel guilty about doing that, and I don't anymore.
Is that your but? Is 100 pages? Yeah. You will give 100 pages, even if you're not enjoying it?
No, that's actually my wife's book club rule. And but I've sort of taken it as my own, because I think say a book is 300 pages, if it's 80,000 words, that's a third of the book. And that's a lot for it not to have grabbed you. Mm. So, no, move on to a book by someone else. And
do any of your books end up in your wife's book
club? God forbid, no. I can't think of anything worse. I sometimes get invited to book clubs, and I do know an author who made the mistake of going along, because they all went, we're very excited to have Julie here, and she's going to tell us all about how she wrote this. And then by the end, they've all had a bottle of wine and go, yeah, I didn't like this either. No, that didn't work for me. Why did you do that?
That was my experience too.
Was it?
Yeah. Is there an author, John, or book that you like to read that will always cheer you up?
I don't know if I read many books more than once. Slaves of Solitude by Patrick Hamilton, I've read several times, and that's a very funny book and a very sort of nuanced study of some characters in a boarding house during the war. I love that one. There's a writer called John Cantor who writes funny novels. I'll read anything by him, so I recommend that as a good funny book. The thing is, there aren't many people writing overt comedy like I do in books. I think they're all a bit more sophisticated than me. My book is three gags to a page, you know, funny set pieces. And that's probably because I come out of television and film that I like to dial up the comedy a bit. So I often see a line on a book that says, laugh out loud. And I read it, I go, well, I sort of smiled on page 78. You know what I mean? But yeah. Okay. It used to be the Asterix books, actually. I used to love going back to those and reading those over and over again.
We always ask about adaptations on this book, film and TV ones. But given your success on the stage, we should ask about a stage adaptation. Do you have a favourite stage adaptation of a novel?
I got that question before I came, and I had to think quite hard about it. I did think that I think the key is to make it something more than just the book on stage, which has actually also been what I've tried to do with like Mrs. Doubtfire and other things that I've adapted, which is like Just for One Day, is a concert on stage. I thought The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime was a great adaptation. Yeah. And just the way it was staged with those lights all around. I really enjoyed the book and I really enjoyed the stage adaptation, but for different reasons. War Horse, I thought, was fantastic at the National. And that was such a theatrical realisation of something that was just on the page. So hats off to that. I've watched bits of Nicholas Nickleby on YouTube, because everyone said you should have seen it. And because I was doing a sort of whole ensemble piece for Just for One Day, I watched bits of that. And I wish I'd caught that at the Barbican when the RSC did that, because everyone said that was fantastic. But apart from that, the one that means the most to me was Winnie the Pooh at the Phoenix Theatre in 1972, because I was Christopher Robin. Age 10. My first words on stage are, wherever I go, there's always poo. And I've tried to keep that going.
Your next memoir should have.
Yes,
that should be.
That should be the title, Wherever I Go, There's Always Poo. That is my sense of humour.
Where do you write best?
I really can write most places. I do like to go to the London Library in St James's Square and get my laptop out there in the reading room. And the good thing about that is there are other writers around, and we go for lunch together. And there's a sort of atmosphere of study in that space, which is nice. But I also write at home a lot. And if my wife comes in and goes, "God, I just had someone be really rude to me in the car," that's fine. That's might be a bit of grit in the oyster that sparks the idea for a scene. So I'm not precious about my time or my space. I also, embarrassed to announce it, but I also have a narrow boat, and I like to go to my narrow boat and write on that. So in the summer, I quite often go for a week, especially when I'm starting a project. Just the loneliness and the concentrated thinking time on a boat is great for me.
Are you taking that narrowboat anywhere, or are you just literally going to where
no,
it's moored?
No, it's moored in Oxford, and I take it upstream because it's so quiet, and I've learned where all the pubs are. And I usually take my dog, and I'll go to the pub in the evening. There's something about writing in the morning, and you get a bit stuck, and then I go, right, I'm going to move up to, you know, the next village, and an hour steering this boat. You're thinking, but you're not thinking. But what you don't realise is your brain is fermenting these ideas, and suddenly you're just coming out of a lock and go, bingo, I know how I solve that scene. And it's a weird subconscious process that goes on when you're writing, that something is trying to be solved without you realising it.
Sounds great.
It is lovely.
As far as your bookshelves are concerned at home, how do you order them? Is there any order, or is it all disorder?
It's very disordered because people keep giving me books to read, and I buy books that I think I'll have time to read and I don't, and I put them horizontal on top of the other shelves. And having just finished, you know, these projects, I tidied out my office yesterday, and bags of books I'm going to give to the charity shop because I won't read them again, or I won't get around to reading them. And now it's this enormous sense of space in my office. My wife buys a lot of books and reads a lot, and we have lots of books in the house, but more than the shelves can manage. So we've actually got into this culture of recycling books, lending books, donating books out, and not endlessly collecting books so that you can't move in our house. So there's no logic to it. I quite like having hardbacks by people I know and friends downstairs, because they come
in
round.
They come round
and go, they're looking at it going, I mean, writers are terrible for that. You see someone on the news going, yes, my husband was kidnapped in Colombia. And I'm just looking at the shelves behind her going, she hasn't got my book. Oh, look, she's got Mark Haddon there.
An interesting glimpse into the paranoid world of writers. So maybe this question is kind of connected to that, as to whether you have a writing routine, which you've kind of hinted at. If you're on the if you're on your longboat, then that's one thing. But if you're working with if it's just you, then obviously that's one thing. But if you're writing collaboratively, can you go to someone's house or go to a cafe? Or?
Well, it's funny, when I was first writing with Wayne and Kerry Kirkpatrick in New York, we rented this flat, and they said, "Well, let's start at 9 tomorrow." And I went, "Great, okay." So I got up at 8, showered, went for a walk in Central Park. Back at the flat at 9 with my pencil sharpened, a blank piece of paper. And at about 9:20, they emerged. And they were like, "So I think this end of act one isn't quite right. Oh, we're working now, are we?" And then one of them gets up and goes to get some chicken from the fridge at 11 and go, "What, is this lunch or breakfast? I don't understand." And so this carried on all day, this sort of low-level creativity. And then at 7 o'clock, we went to the bar and I ordered a pint of Guinness. And they went, "So the end of act one." I went, "Oh, no." I thought, we're still working. I was ready at 9 a.m. to work hard and work right through the day. But they sort of simmer the whole time. So I found that quite hard to adjust to. Right. Whereas when it's me, I get up, I'll walk the dog, and I'll go to a cafe or my office or to the London Library, and I'll work till 6, and then I'll stop. And I don't get my laptop out in the evening to write down. I might write on a piece of paper if I have an idea, but I don't keep working at 7, 8, 9 at night. Whereas the Americans sort of do keep doing that in all walks of life, I would say. They answer emails at night if you email them. Sunday morning, they reply. They say, "Are you available for a phone call?" It's like, no, I'm a writer and I work office hours.
It's the Lord's Day.
Yes, just do that. That's a good thing. Yeah. I think you're a Christian Republican and they won't want to work with you.
how are you with deadlines? Because my impression is that you've worked, it's obviously TV, very strict deadlines there that must not be broken. But how are you with them? Do you enjoy them? Do you benefit from them?
I think I probably did when I was starting out. I don't know if I could have written a book without somebody expecting me to deliver a book. I am very embarrassed as a writer to say that I usually hit my deadlines, which is, I know, is an absolute transgression of the union of novelists. But if I have a deadline, I feel it's quite rude if the publishers have got a whole slot for me in the bookshops and there's a whole process that has to be gone through. So I work hard to hit a deadline, or I don't make unrealistic deadlines. In the past, I have had to have a book pushed back a month or two because I couldn't manage to do it. But yeah, I think it's very easy for people like me to go, oh, just write. You should just write your novel. But if no one is waiting for it and there's no deadline, it's much, much harder than it is if you've been commissioned and people are waiting for it. It's a great motivator.
Finally, you are throwing a fantasy dinner party and you can invite three authors, living or dead. Who's coming?
Do you know what? She is living, but I just read the essays of Anne Patchett and I thought she sounded like somebody who I'd really love to have dinner with. So, in fact, she wrote an essay in that collection that talked about book covers. And that's why my book has got such a lovely cover, because I kept getting these covers from Transworld and I kept going, it's okay. And Bill had made me do about three or four rewrites on this book beyond those that I was expecting. And in the end, I was able to go to him, look, I've worked really hard to get this cover right. Can we work a bit harder to get this book right? Can we get this cover right? And then he just sent me the link to this particular designer. And immediately I went, oh, fantastic. That's so great, Bill. And that's why I love my cover on Family Politics so much. So Anne Patchett, I'd love to meet her. I'd love to meet Elizabeth Taylor and tell her how great she is, because in her lifetime, she was not particularly celebrated. And after that, maybe Patrick Hamilton, who I mentioned, Slaves of Solitude. I've loved his other novels, his other London books. More obvious choice, George Orwell. Quite like to chat politics with him, although I think I'd probably find him quite difficult. An old Etonian who
you're gonna have to knock
Independent Labour Party.
Okay, but you're going to have to knock one of those out.
Oh, knock out George Orwell. It's too obvious. And he'd be annoying and he'd talk about himself and he'd be posh. And I'd be disappointed that he expresses himself better in words than he would do around the dinner table. And he'd probably talk over Anne Patchett and Elizabeth Taylor as well. So we're not having that.
So for class reasons,
George is out, mate.
Do you think they get...
Actually, Patrick Hamilton went to Eton as well, so I'm afraid...
So Patrick Hamilton, Elizabeth Taylor, Anne Patchett, do you think they'd get on?
I don't imagine they would. I think Elizabeth Taylor's quite posh as well, I think. So this
is going to be a very...
They're all very posh.
Yeah. Well, Anne Patchett probably might not be, but I don't know. I think I'd just leave them to it and give them nibbles and, see how we
got on.
This
feels like a dinner party where you invited them all and then within 10 minutes you had enough.
The thing is, writers are interesting because of what they write, not necessarily what they're like when you have dinner. I say that, but at the London Library, I go out for lovely lunches with Victoria Hislop and Daisy Goodwin and Lizzie Evans. And that's very civilised, but we only dive into the cafe and have sandwiches in the square.
John O'Farrell, thank you very much indeed. Family Politics is published by Doubleday. It's out now. If you want to get in touch, you can email booksoftheyear@yahoo.com or go via our socials. We'll be back for another episode next week. We're clearly not quite sure.
No idea who's coming on.
But it'll be someone...
Someone great.
Someone great, but not quite as great.
Not as good as John.
Oh,
as John.
Thanks for having me on.